Next up on This Week in Law, we've got Monica Goyle, Jeff Richardson, and Evan Brown and me, and we're going to talk about Mike Tyson and Dr. Dre, Judge Posner thrown in there for good measure, the Olympics and the law, tech replacing lawyer, and lots more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 174, recorded August 10, 2012. Bad Yelps about the haggis. Hi, folks. It's Denise Howell here with Evan Brown, and you have tuned in for This Week in Law, where we sit down and consider all of the ways and all of the recent developments that technology law is impacting our lives. So that just keeps going and going, and so do we. And we've got a great panel to do it with this week. Joining us from Toronto, Canada, is attorney Monica Goyle. Hello, Monica.
Hi, Denise. Thank you for having me on the show.
It's wonderful to have you. Monica both practices law with Fleet Street Law and has a great side project, or maybe it's more than a side project. We'll talk about it toward the end of the show, called My Legal Briefcase. That sounds like a great tool for people to check out. Also joining us, a return visit to TWiL, is Jeff Richardson from iPhone JD. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, Denise. Good to see you again.
Good to see you, too. How's New Orleans?
New Orleans is doing fabulous. Thank you.
Good, good. Have you seen our friend Ernie Svensson in a while?
I see Ernie all the time. Yes, indeed. Ernie's a great guy.
Oh, good. Buy him a beer for us. We miss him. Jeff is also in private practice down there in New Orleans. He's at Adams and Reese there. And, of course, my co-host Evan is at Hinshaw and Culbertson in Chicago. Welcome back, Evan.
Hey, it's great to be back, Denise. I've really missed it. You know, been out a few weeks here, so back in the saddle again. And you know, I go away for a couple weeks, and stuff doesn't stop happening. You know, it's like overwhelming to see what's happening in this space that we talk about week after week here. So it ought to be like usual, a great conversation today, and I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too. Hey, I had to just tell you, had it on my list that we watched the, I guess it was Transformers Dark Side of the Moon the other night.
Yeah.
And I think it was on one of our older shows that they were filming that outside your window. So I kept looking for you in the background.
Yeah, you might have seen me just waving out of the window at some point. But yeah, that had Chicago, you know, pretty well blocked up. And yeah, they were filming right outside my window, even like while we were doing the show one day. So it's, good stuff. Good flick.
Yes, hopefully no Decepticons will come a-knocking while we do the show today.
Right. So far, no.
Yeah, if they do, be sure and, you know, stick the mic in front of their face. I'm sure we could have an interesting discussion about, you know, their DRM and such.
Right.
Well, one area where DRM comes up a lot is in the copyright arena. And we've got some really interesting developments, interesting cases that have come down in that area in the last week or so. Let's talk about FlavaWorks v. MyVidster, which happened in your neck of the woods, Evan. It's a decision by Judge Posner, and it's a real interesting decision on, it involves sites where people aggregate videos and they get embedded there, but not hosted there, that may or may not be infringing. MyVidster is a video bookmarking site. So you would go there and sort of watch videos that other people have curated. And of course, a good number of those, according to the lawsuit, were infringing. And that's why this lawsuit was brought. FlavaWorks is an adult porn site or adult, you know, entertainment site specializing in homosexual videos, I believe. So they came and sued and were unhappy. Actually, this case reminded me, Evan, a little bit of way, way back in the beginnings of technology decisions, the Ticketmaster versus, I know Ticketmaster was one of the parties, But it involved linking past the front door and deep linking. And it was a district court case out of California, but it was one of the first cases that established that, yes, indeed, you cannot be held liable for routing around someone's front door where they may have advertising that they want you to see, et cetera, and deep linking them into the site. And even though this isn't, you know, an identical kind of situation, FlavaWorks was unhappy because of their paywall no longer being viable. And that's really kind of a design issue for them, maybe more than a legal issue, don't you think, Evan?
Yeah, I do. And at a certain level, we may not learn a whole lot more from this decision than what we knew already from that Ticketmaster versus Tickets.com case. Franklin, our intern, is helping us out in the IRC with that. That goes, you know, that's like a mid to late 90s case about deep linking and going around the front door. And I'm not going to make any of the obvious jokes that could be relevant here, given that this is a gay porn site. But in any event,
yeah, exactly.
what was really at issue here was this, or at least the cultural part of it that was at issue, the internet cultural part of that that's so front and center with all this, is the ability to embed a video. And you use the term curation. I think that's one of the buzzwords where we're supposed to throw confetti and ring bells and stuff every time that's mentioned on the show. This notion of curation, such a buzzword in, with the use of the tools that we have today. So the legal issue in the case was whether or not my Vidster was a contributory infringer by creating this and providing this functionality for others to embed videos on its site and allow this curation to take place. And the short answer was no. Now, Judge Posner opinions are oftentimes inscrutable, and this one is largely inscrutable as well, because it's just the way Judge Posner writes, it's the way he thinks. Eric Goldman, in his post about running down the decision, I think pretty aptly characterized the Judge Posner opinion as being like a barely edited first draft. You know, it's often stream of consciousness, and it's very, Judge Posner certainly thinks about these things and is a brilliant legal mind. But at the same time, these decisions are hard to read, and Judge Posner has a tendency to write more like a law review article, going off on tangents and things like that. So one of the interesting things that he says in the opinion, which Professor Goldman picked up on his rundown, is some comments that he made about the question of sideloading. Judge Posner doesn't use the term sideloading in his opinion, but in kind of addressing an issue that wasn't right before the court, he talked about Judge Posner surmised that if my Vidster were to have created a backup copy or an archive copy on its own server of these videos to which it was essentially providing a link in the non-premium part of its service, that would constitute a direct copyright infringement. And then it's not too hard to go a couple of steps in the analysis and be worried about the likes of Pinterest, which Pinterest does, as we've talked about on the show before, provides the tool for the user to make a copy of content that's on the Pinterest server. So there's a lot of stuff that's tied into this case that presents issues that we that are pertinent to the way that these tools work and the abilities that they give us to manage and curate content. It's difficult to read, but it certainly does say some intriguing things about the state of copyright law and this notion of secondary liability and what can happen when users are given these tools and they indeed put them to use.
Well, go ahead, Jeff.
I was just going to say, one of the parts of the opinion that I thought was interesting is when Judge Posner pointed out that to the extent that my Vidster was letting people get past a paywall to get into the site, that perhaps that would be stealing, because the user was watching a video without paying for it. But stealing is a different crime, a different lawsuit, different offense. That's not the same as copyright infringement. And he had an interesting analogy to, if all that my Vidster was doing was providing an address and a title of what the video was, not unlike what a newspaper, might say, if you go to such and such theater at such and such time, here's the movies playing there. My Vidster wasn't hosting them. As Evan said, he didn't copy them. So I thought that was sort of interesting, is, people want to call things copyright law, but just because they're not copyright law doesn't mean that they're not actionable and a person maybe can't be sued or prosecuted some other way.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. And the takeaways from this case, you know, depending on how it's going to be picked up and cited and used by other courts, are that embedding an infringing video is not going to make you liable for secondary or contributory infringement, as you just pointed out. And also watching such videos don't involve any infringement by the part of the viewer. So that's a really important point, something we've talked about on the show before, that, you know, if you're using YouTube to try and find the chopped up 10-minute versions of your favorite shows and watching them all, you know, are you actually infringing in doing that? And, you know, this case indicates no, and we'll have to, again, watch how other courts pick that up and decide to apply it. Monica, do you have any thoughts on this?
I think that Evan did a good job of, you know, discussing what Judge Posner's decision. One of the things that I thought was interesting too was that in this particular case, Guttner, he refused to take down the video. So he actually was not able to rely on Section 512. And so this decision is then outside of that, of the copyright and the safe harbor clause. So that's, to me, like a really good kind of step forward in terms of expanding when, in terms of the linking and when you can link and not having to rely on the Copyright Act.
Yeah, Judge Posner pretty much decided that Section 512 just didn't even need to come into play here because nobody was involved in any infringement for which they needed a safe harbor. Let me clarify that. Someone was involved in infringement, but they weren't a party to the case. The person who had found the videos and uploaded them to my Vidster, that person may have some problems. But as far as a business model and the legality of what my Vidster was doing, this case seems like a vindication. Eric Goldman, good friend of the show, really, really didn't like this decision and has a very interesting, great post on his site about it. It thinks it's just the reason I keep saying, you know, it depends on how other courts are going to use this is Professor Goldman doesn't think that this case is going to be very precedential because he just thinks it's so dismally put together and it's going to be difficult to cite. But, you know, it's out there and I think other courts will definitely bring it up. He didn't like the Amster decision that Judge Posner wrote much either, but, you know, that certainly had an impact too. Evan, any thoughts on the aftermath of Professor Goldman's article?
Well, you know, I'm always careful what I say about Judge Posner because it's conceivable that I could find myself arguing in front of his court, you know, being that mm-hmm. I practice here in Chicago. And so, of course, he's always right. He's always great. Very. Amster was correctly decided, as was this one, right? You know, so I've already said how difficult it is to understand what Judge Posner writes. Not right. that it's because he's incorrect or because, and I'm being serious about that, not just trying to pander or be a psychophant about it, but, you know, it's just the way that he writes is very, very difficult to read. It's not what we're used to. Kind of when we read a case, we get into certain modes, like here are the facts, here's the discussion, and it's just, you don't see that in a Posner opinion. But the one thing that I would like to comment on about this case before we move on to the next topic is this idea of what we were talking about just a moment ago about Judge Posner surmising, and I think this would be dicta, that if just watching a video without making a copy of it would not be a copyright infringement. And that principle, mm-hmm. which I think is correct under copyright law, because doing that doesn't implicate any of the exclusive rights of the copyright holder under Section 106 of the Act. It's not making a copy. It's not publicly distributing. It's not distributing it. It's not publicly performing it at all, any of that stuff. But that principle shines a light on one of the awkward or weird aspects of modern copyright law, because it it turns on a very often meaningless technological distinction, like whether or not there's actually a local cached copy that you may or may not know about when you're watching streaming content is definitive of, as to whether you have committed infringement, when your experience as the user is exactly the same, whether it purely is streaming or whether that cached copy was made somewhere behind the scenes in, you know, in a cache on in your browser or something. So right. what that makes me think of is how useful revisiting Copyright Act and looking at the right of access would be a meaningful discussion to have in copyright reform rather than continuing to go through these awkward machinations with copyright law of those kinds of distinctions that turn merely on some minor technological detail.
Right. Excellent point. And the whole Pinterest problem is all tied up in that too. You know, the users don't know how Pinterest works or that the fact that it's, you know, faster because it's sideloading. And there's another buzzword we should probably define in case anyone's not familiar with what we mean there. I think you kind of did earlier, Evan, that basically it's just making a local copy. And maybe it's just a euphemism. You know, if someone were to sue, there really wouldn't be too much protection if you were hiding behind the term sideloading. You're making a local copy. You agree?
Yep.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. Because you don't know what it means. And it's not in the opinion. That's just kind of the popular nomenclature for it.
Right. Jeff, what were you going to say?
Different. Oh, you were just talking about the critique of Judge Posner. I mean, I was going to point out, unlike Evan, I'm not a member of the Seventh Circuit Bar. I'm on the other side of the Mississippi River down here in the Fifth Circuit. But Judge Posner is certainly the only Seventh Circuit judge that I can name because his opinions, although sometimes unconventional, are always interesting reads. It's you know, whenever there's a big case before him, I'll usually go out of my way to see what he had to say about it because you know that, you know, it could be entertaining if nothing else.
Yes,
for sure.
He's like Judge Kaczynski. Well, not that I would ever, again, I face the Evan problem here. Not that I would ever say that Judge Kaczynski would ever have an incorrect or poorly reasoned decision, but he really doesn't. He's really quite an excellent judge, but his decisions are very entertainingly written as well and always a good read. All right, well, let's move on from the resolution of that case to the beginning of another, this one involving Electronic Arts and Zynga. And this is a fun case for us to talk about this week because we're going to talk about Apple versus Samsung a little bit later. And even though this is on the copyright side and involves video games and not handset hardware, it reminds me, again, of the same kind of situations. It's a good kind of parallel for how IP law works on both sides. Because the crux of this case, it's EA here suing Zynga over Zynga's game, The Ville, which EA says is too much like the Sims social game. It's really a question of, well, you know, they just look a lot alike. They do a lot of the same things. And the real interesting question here is the copyrightability and the extent of copyrightability of the concept of this kind of a game, which doesn't really have a plot. It's you know, characters are given various abilities and can walk around and do things in the game. But there's no sort of ongoing story. There aren't really, you know, goals that you achieve and level up and all of that kind of thing. It's more of an experiential experience. So this one has just been filed. And again, Professor Goldman has a great piece on it. If you would like to see more details about it and take a look at the key parts of the complaint. But I just think it's a really interesting case. And I think it's fun, too, that we're talking about it in the middle of summer, because this is the kind of case that law firms, before they file, love to throw their summer associates at and say, OK, so go play these games and tell us how they're similar and how they're different. And then the summer associates get to go back to law school and say, oh, this law firm was so cool. I got to play video games for my job. It was awesome. So hopefully some students got to have some fun with this before it got filed. Evan, what do you think of this one?
The copyright issues that are presented in this can really be both fascinating and maddening You know, those are certainly not mutually exclusive concepts when it comes to this. What we're talking about here, really, when we get down to the merits of the copyright claims, goes to the idea expression dichotomy, which is a doctrine in copyright law, which simply states that ideas are not protectable. Mere concepts, for example, in video games, the rule set, and this is kind of an issue we talked about a couple of episodes ago in that Tetris case out of New Jersey. You know, and when you're looking at what is protectable under copyright law in a video game, the fundamental rule set and the way that it's played and the concept is not protectable by copyright. But as with any creative work, the particular expression, so long as it has that spark of originality, which is a very, very, has to only meet a very low threshold, it's only that creative expression that is protected by copyright. So what we have in the comparison with the EA game and the Zynga game, the very similar characters and features and functionality and things that are expressed that are so close to that indeterminate point, and that's the word that Professor Goldman, Eric Goldman's really hitting on all cylinders these days with all his commentary on these things, law and technology. The word he uses is to describe that indeterminate point where an idea is expressed with enough particularity and enough creativity so that copyright law steps in and provides protection, and it rises to the level of copyrightability, and therefore there can be infringement if that is copied. So this is just one. The reason I say that these things are maddening is because these issues are so metaphysical when you're talking about whether or not something is just an idea or whether it really is an expression. That's really at a very fundamental cognitive level. What's the word I'm looking for? It's that whole epistemology. You know, it's that whole at a weird epistemological level of what we know and what we don't know. Like if Aristotle and Plato had written things differently in ancient Greece and hadn't set our minds up to thinking of ideals and particulars, this wouldn't exist in copyright law. But when you get down to this real fundamental way of how we think about things, it's hard to parse those really fine gray areas when it comes to the idea expression dichotomy, and video games like this give us a wonderful opportunity to do that. So really, really, it should be some fun things to see in this.
Well, now I just want my own Aristotle character in either the Sims game or the Zynga game, because why wouldn't you?
Right,
Monica. There you go. Monica, what do you think about all this?
I agree. You know, I think Evan is dead on. But the other thing, you know, what Evan has indicated is that there's this real problem in this particular complaint, like that EA has to show that this was an expression versus that this was an idea. So Goldman, in his article, has a really good example of somebody who has to go to the potty. And
yes,
they're,
that's
like,
my favorite point.
Yeah, the avatar with the like pigeon toes. And if you look at the complaint, they actually have side by side images of the two games. And if you look at that particular image, I mean, it does look visually very different. So are they trying to, in this particular case, are they trying to protect the, you know, the concept, this game concept? And is that more of an idea versus, you know, an expression of that idea? And so as I was reading the Goldman's blog, one of the things he touched upon was these corporate rating of EA's employees. And kind of mentioning that as maybe a possible reason why this action was started, because there seems to be, you know, some challenges with proving this particular case, like whether or not this is copyrightable material. And the second point that Goldman makes, which I thought was really good, was about that people freely copy each other all the time. So, you know, a person came up with the idea of a first-person shooter game, and mm-hmm. but we know there's tons of them in the market. So it will be interesting to see how this transpires, if they do actually proceed forward, or, you know, this is more of a, you know, bargaining position for them to address the corporate rating of their employees.
Yeah. Any judge with young children is going to balk at the idea that the only way to express someone having to go to the bathroom is someone standing there pigeon-toed. You know, they could throw in a dozen other examples of how that could be expressed. So I don't know that that would factor into the decision-making process, but it's bound to have some kind of role. Okay, well, let's move on and talk next about the Olympics. All kinds of good things to Evan. Do you like our new bumpers?
That's pretty awesome. It certainly got my attention. You know?
We're going to have to do something to fade the sound at the end. It cuts off a little abruptly.
It's like a Rush Limbaugh show all of a sudden.
Yeah,
you know, can't exactly. Like the applause. Yeah.
Yep. Oh well, you know, we'll just play that in the background the whole time. Little applause track for everything that we say will be nice and self-esteem building. A lot of it's been happening. We talked about the Olympics last week, and I knew there would be more to discuss this week, and there is. So we discussed the framework around ambush marketing and how people were going to try and get away with things and what they were up against. And in fact, there have been a couple of instances of people working the rules. And I think the Dr. Dre one, I don't know, you guys will have to tell me if you think he has run afoul of it. But Dr. Dre has customized some of his great Beats headphones and delivered them to the Great Britain, I forget exactly which team, it might have been the entire Olympic team, but some of the athletes then tweeted about it, hey, you know, loving my new Dre Beats, with, la la la, Great Britain customized. So that's the kind of thing that the rules are designed to discourage, and yet it is indeed happening. And then another interesting one was Nike ran a campaign that I think probably complied with the rules. And that had to do with different places in the world called London and associating itself with Londons in Australia and the United States, et cetera. And, you know, never directly referring to the Olympics, but getting its brand associated with it in that way too. And of course, not, you know, these rules are so difficult for me to even conceive of enforcing because these non-official sponsors are all over the games anyway, with the athletes, you know, wearing their Nike headbands and their Nike shoes. And so it just kind of seems to me like a silly distinction to make. Evan, what do you think?
Well, is this the Dr. Dre that was in NWA? If so, you know, nobody's going to think that he would have any qualms about this guerrilla marketing like this. So, yeah. You know, where do we start? I know that there's been some discussion about the Olympics and all of this marketing stuff. You know, you talked about that in the last episode. So, you know, I don't want to be too repetitious about getting at the real larger picture issues on all this. But it certainly is problematic when you get to, trying to regulate what a company is going to do. You raise a very good point. It's difficult to enforce the companies who are, you know, these sponsored, unauthorized companies doing this, where the real sting can be felt is in punishing the athletes if they are to do something that violates Rule 40. And that really brings into question, you know, what is the right attitude to have toward the corporate involvement with the Olympics? And, you know, is there any hypocrisy on the part of the International Olympic Committee to say that, you know, there's only going to be these certain sponsors and, you know, therefore we are, you know, keeping it sort of controlled and vanilla because we don't want it to be corrupted by a bunch of individual interests by athletes promoting their own things. You know, it's just kind of hard to say either of these positions with a straight face too much. You know, I guess one of the fortunate things is it only comes around every 4 years. And so once, you know, we would actually get to any resolution on this or any kind of sense of satisfaction, we'll have moved on to other things to think about for the next 3 years and 50 weeks or whatever that there are until the next summer Olympic Games on all this. So yeah, it's difficult. And with the Dr. Dre thing in particular, you know, it's there's something that we enjoy as participants in a free market economy, the ability to market your products in a way that you see fit, unrestricted and unregulated by rather arbitrary regulations or rules or whatever that would come down like this. There's probably a cultural, country-specific, certain economy perspective centric view or specific view of how that should all go. It's problematic. That's all I can really say.
Yeah, someone in IRC is saying that some athletes were forced to take a banner off their balcony. I'm wondering if any of them have gotten bounced over from the games over these ambush marketing things that they are taking part in. You know, whether just to express their enthusiasm for a product seems a bit extreme to get bounced from the games, but technically.
I find.
Go ahead,
what
Jeff.
What I find funny about that, Denise, is that one of the articles described that there are apparently 300 advertising police, did y'all see this, that wear purple uniforms and just go around looking for violations. And I don't know, I just thought I've never heard of an advertising police in a purple uniform before. That was sort of a funny image in my head.
That is.
The purple ad cops. Monica, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's two things here. One is about, you know, should the Olympians be focused on promoting products, or should they be, you know, participating in the games? And so I think there is, for some people, is kind of like, you know, is this really what their role should be? Like, I'm not sure personally. I'm not really sure that, you know, they should be on Twitter promoting products. I mean, it's not about, you know, human rights. It's not about the game, you know. You know, what should the role of the Olympian be? And that kind of, you know, goes to some, there were a few Olympians that were kicked out of their, out of the group because they made comments on Twitter that was considered racist or considered inappropriate, or posting pictures on Facebook. And that, I think, is clearly, you know, unsportsmanlike behavior. So I think the other challenge with this particular issue is that, you know, this is somehow treading on our free expression, you know, freedom to associate and be our own person. But at the same time, it's like, you know, what is an Olympian and what does that mean?
Right. You know, I did see a good op-ed on this. I'm not sure who wrote it. It just sort of breezed by me in the last week about how, you know, formerly when Olympians protested, it was on large social issues and human rights and civil rights issues. And now we've got people, you know, ticked off they can't promote their personal sponsors. Or in the case of these guys, Nick Darcy and Kenrick Monk from Australia, now, this seems, you know, kind of an extreme response on the Olympics organizing people's parts. They had a picture that was well prior to the games of themselves in a gun store on Facebook that was publicly viewable, and it was found, and they decided that was an inappropriate image for Olympians. And so they participated in their events, and then they were asked to leave, which... You know, I don't know. It's like the teacher in Germany drinking a beer who got fired from her job. It just seems like maybe a little bit out of proportion to the actual event. But then, as you point out, Monica, there have been some very directly related to the games, sort of hostile, petty comments about other competitors related to racial slurs and things that I think rightly got people bounced out. So, you know, the social media spigot doesn't go off just because the games are on, and folks are going to have to keep an eye on what they're saying. Jeff, any other thoughts on this before we move on?
You know, only that when I saw the example of the person tweeting, you know, racial statements that were clearly inappropriate and getting sanctions as a result of that, of course, that seems fine. My only concern is where you draw the line. And the one thought that I had is, by all reports that I have seen, the London Olympics have been very gay-friendly, even though there aren't terribly many. I think there's maybe 23 of the thousands of athletes that are officially out. But there is actually a gay pride house right near the events that's officially sanctioned by the Olympics. And what I thought was interesting is the Winter Olympics, which are going to be in Russia in 2 years, there was a case there. It wasn't in the show notes. I don't have the link with me. But there was somebody wanted to have something similar in that town. You know, Russia, homosexuality was illegal there until 1993. And a lot of people in that country still have some of those same feelings. And somebody tried to have a similar just pavilion for, you know, gay athletes at the upcoming Russian Olympics in 2 years. And the Russian court shut it down and said no. And I don't know all the specifics of that case. And maybe it was just an issue of a late permit. But you know, whenever you're drawing lines of, you know, this is appropriate and this is not, I always just get worried about who draws the lines and what if that person drawing the lines draws it differently from where I would draw the lines. It's a tough issue. It's a tough issue.
All right. Well, one other interesting legal point or aspect of the games has been how you watch them. NBC has been taking tons of flack. And in fact, there's been a funny graphic going around that hopefully we can show because, of course, NASA and JPL did some great things in the last few days and managed to broadcast them all with only a 14-minute delay. Somebody put together a great graphic, hoping or wondering why NBC wasn't able to do such a thing. Do we have that, Colin? I'll throw it up in a second. But there it is. Oh.
Well, it's not quite that's a great graphic, too, but not the right one.
Yeah. No, we're not quite. It's not quite patent time, but the graphic in question just compares NBC to NASA JPL and wonders why, you know, 14 minutes all the way across the solar system versus 8 hours. There we go. Yes, Stephen Colbert had some fun with this too. There it is. 8 hours just, you know, from the UK to the US, which Colin in the studio rightly pointed out to me before the show that, you know, that sort of assumes that this isn't a choice on NBC's part, which of course it is. They're trying to target their programming to a particular audience at a particular time. So if they wanted to do live or 14 minutes, they certainly could. But the way that people have been getting around this, and Dale Dietrich over on Google Plus suggested that we discuss this. Thank you, Dale, for the suggestion, through using proxies that make it appear as though you are authorized to view the live BBC coverage or other people who are offering the coverage live. I don't know if BBC is the only one, but basically routing around NBC as the sole provider of the games in the U.S. And certainly there are terms of service issues with doing that. I'm kind of interested in the liability attaching to the proxy service business model. And this is something that expatriates outside the U.S. have done for a long time to be able to catch the broadcasts that they otherwise wouldn't be able to if they weren't in the U.S. And I think it's definitely, you know, to say the least, in a legal gray area. What do you think, Jeff?
Jeff dropped. We are calling him back.
Ah, all right. We will get Jeff's thoughts in a minute. How about you, Evan?
When it goes to the question of liability for the operators of the proxy services, a couple of things come to mind. And these are, I guess, under the headings of revisiting the idea here for the second time in the episode of secondary liability for copyright infringement, because there would be case law, and this, I mean, this of course is a big, huge international issue, so I'm glossing over a lot of the stuff by just thinking from an American legal perspective. I know that there's case law from several American courts that say accessing content in violation of the terms of service or beyond the scope of what's permitted under the terms of service is a copyright infringement. So then the question then becomes, is this provider of a proxy service, which through which you can access, or it's not really through which, but I guess the best way of saying it is that it provides you how do you say it? I mean, it really is kind of the causal link that gets you around the restrictions, the geographically based restrictions that are otherwise there. I'd have to kind of think about exactly what it is, how we'd want to characterize that. So is it helping you infringe copyright by getting it in excess of the terms of service? And then also, you know, there's just the kind of the another form of secondary liability for inducing the breach of the contract between you and the terms of the provider of the service, you know, pursuant to these terms of service there. So, you know, there could be some liability, but it I think is going to depend on how the provider of the proxy service is going to market their service and, you know, what it is that they're actually doing to aid in getting this content to places on the globe where it's the providers of that content, the originators of that content, didn't intend for it to be. So there's something there, but it's not really clear cut that they're doing anything wrong, especially if you got thousands of people doing it.
Yeah, it kind of gets us back to Judge Posner's reasoning that, yeah, well, you know, it might not be right, and certainly they've tried to prevent you from doing it, but is it really copyright infringement to do this kind of thing? Probably not, as far as I'm concerned. You know, you're not really making a copy. It might be, you might have more of a DMCA circumventing rights protection kind of an issue. What do you think, Monica?
This is interesting. One of the issues is, I think also some of these servers are not located in the U.S. I mean, they're located in other countries. So there's a question of whether or not you're going to have jurisdiction to, you know, stop them from providing these services. And it kind of reminds me, I mean, not that it's an exact analogy, but in during the Arab Spring and in Egypt, what we saw is the government trying to like shut down, you know, communications outside of communications, so people couldn't communicate outside of Egypt. And it seems to me that, you know, although this is much, much different, it's the idea being that you're trying to create this jurisdiction where it really isn't. So the internet is this global, and what we've tried to do is by identifying with the IP addresses where you're located. But this is an imperfect way of doing things, and there are very easy workarounds to it. And so I think that whenever you're going to try and restrict people's access, there are ways, there's going to be ways, and there's going to be people who are going to provide those ways to access that content. So, I mean, in this particular case, if you are outside of the U.S. And you can access YouTube services. So YouTube is streaming, has 10 HD signals streaming to 64 countries for free. So in this particular case, people in the U.S. aren't able to access all that great content.
Yeah, Jeff, I think you're back with us now. We've been talking about people watching the Olympics via proxy services that get them to broadcasts that they wouldn't otherwise have access to without using a proxy service.
Right.
Do you see any legal issues here beyond just a, you know, terms of service violation on the part of the broadcaster-viewer relationship? Do you think that the proxy service in the middle is doing something that is actionable? And let me just make this question even more convoluted. Do you think that it's really on the broadcaster to make sure that proxy spoofing isn't possible?
Yeah, and you know, it's impossible. That's the thing. It's going to be technically possible for people to get access to what they want. It all reminds me of, there's a TechHive article on an...
Oh, darn. I think he may have frozen again.
Mm-hmm. Can you hear
all
me
right,
now?
Well, oh, yeah. No, we got you back. Good.
Okay. Hopefully you can hear me. The TechHive article described ways of watching the BBC signal inappropriately, perhaps. And I tried one of them that the article recommended because I was curious. It was one called Add the Net. And it was neat that with just a couple clicks, I was suddenly watching live BBC, all the, you know, the coverage that I might want to watch that NBC does not show me. But at the same time, my screen was so full of...
The I'm suspense guessing. Is killing me.
Yes, I know. Ads.
You know, in the meantime, have you checked out Sarcastic Rover on Twitter?
Yes, I love Sarcastic Rover on Twitter, but I haven't checked it in the last couple of days. What has Sarcastic Rover been saying?
First data from Mars. Lots of rocks, mostly red. Everything's cold. Surprisingly high levels of depression. One of the best ones, I'm trying to find it here, is like, so I, you know, because one of his key phrases, I did a science. And he's like, I did a science and found out it was all Diet Pepsi. Can we never come here again? Okay.
It's the best. All right, Jeff, what was your screen so full of? You left us hanging.
It was full of just ridiculous ads that I can only imagine what viruses I would have gotten if I had clicked them. But you know what it reminded me of? It reminded me of, you know, was it 10 years ago in the days of Napster, where people wanted access to the digital songs and couldn't get them. And so you would turn to these services that were illegal and would often give you viruses. And then Apple comes along and says, look, we want to make something that is so easy to use that you don't mind paying because it's you want to do the right thing. It's just you can't. And I feel that's the same way. You know, people want full access to everything. And some people have cut the cord and no longer get cable television. And, you know, people wonder why won't NBC or just, you know, let people pay $100 to watch whatever they want, even if you don't belong to cable. But then the answer to that is HBO, because a lot of people that don't subscribe to cable have been clamoring, you know, I wish I could just buy HBO a la carte. And, you know, the HBO doesn't know what they're doing. And yet I think HBO is reporting, you know, record profits. So I guess they do know what they're doing. But the people want what the people want, and they're going to get it no matter what.
Yeah, they sure are. I do think that this is exactly that kind of parallel situation, and that something's going to give here. I'm not sure what it is. There's so much regulation involved in who can broadcast what and where and when that it's just a huge mess. But you're right. Some the fact that people just want to cut through the mess and see what they want to see and don't want to have windowing and don't want to have delays is just going to continue to push out the end around solutions. Monica, any final thoughts on this before we move on?
Nope.
Alrighty then. So we ran our little patent time bumper. We won't run it for you again, but it is patent time, finally. Let us talk about the Apple versus Samsung case, which, you know, I'm thinking, I haven't been following the testimony all that closely this week, but I'm thinking that the fat lady may have sung this. I picked up off Jeff's site this morning, missed it when it aired, but hopefully we've got it queued up and can play it. When Conan O'Brien has decided which party to make fun of, things may all be over. Colin?
Apple is claiming that Samsung copied iPhone technology to market its own products. Well, Samsung's vice president of electronics has already released a video that's defending his company. It's a video message defending Samsung. Let's take a look.
Hello. Apple's claim that Samsung has copied their technology is an allegation we're vigorously denying. Since we entered the personal electronics space, Samsung has created products that, as you can see, bear no similarity to Apple's. Notice the grayer edge of our Galaxy phone. And what about our Galaxy tablet? Not even close. It's not just electronics. Samsung's originality is also on display in our home appliances, whether it's our new microwave oven, our Vac Pro vacuum cleaner, or eye washer with scroll wheel control. Don't believe me? Then come to our retail stores, where you can talk more about our products with a Samsung smart guy. And, you know, a lot of people ask, how does Samsung stay so original?
All right,
so
Colin, original? I think we get the idea.
We stay true.
That is just awesome. And again, you know, like the EA case we were discussing earlier, I think a lot of people are looking at this case going, you know, these things are pretty darn similar. Jeff, you're our iPhone JD expert here. What do you think, getting down more into the nitty-gritty of the case?
Oh, the case has been so much fun. By the way, can you see or hear me? Because I can't see you at all right now.
Yeah, I think we turned off video to you because that's going to hopefully help keep you on with us.
That's awesome. Great. The trial has just been so much. Frankly, I'm enjoying it as much as I'm enjoying the Olympics right now. It's just so interesting what's coming out. You started off over the last week with Phil Schiller and Scott Forstall talking about the process of the creation of the iPhone, which is just so interesting because Apple never likes to talk about what they do and why they do it, and here they are in court having to explain everything. So it's interesting. But from the legal standpoint on, you know, the designs, one of the things that I thought was interesting is that Apple brought as an expert witness Susan Kare, K-A-R-E, and Susan is, if you'll excuse the pen, an icon in icons. I mean, she is the one
who worked for Apple.
She worked for Apple in the early days for the first 2 years and came up with so many icons that are still being used in graphic user interfaces today. And although she hasn't worked for Apple in, 25 years, she did work with Steve Jobs at Next and she worked for Microsoft. I mean, she knows more about icons than anyone. So when she was testifying about how similar the Samsung phones are to the iPhone, you know, she was talking about how when she was even in a conference room preparing to testify, she picked up the wrong phone because they looked so alike. On cross-examination, she was asked, you know, one of the things they complain about is the phone button on an iPhone, of course, is a picture of a phone at an angle in white on a green background. And on the Samsung phones, it's a picture of a phone in white at an angle on a green background. And the Samsung attorney on cross of Kare tried to say, well, isn't it true?
And once again, I think Jeff left us no.
There's so many different ways to display a phone. And then the Samsung attorney asked Susan Kare, you know, isn't it true that the color green, Apple doesn't own the color green? Green means go, so isn't it appropriate to use? But the reality is so many features really do look the same between the phones that I think it's then going to become a question of intent. And from there, one of the most – I guess there were two big developments this week that I thought were significant. One of them was that Samsung has been trying to keep out of evidence this one document that talks about – see, what is the phrase in it? The phrase in the document was a crisis of design, and on Monday afternoon Apple had called it as an adverse witness, Justin Dennison, who is a Samsung chief strategy officer. And on the when the Samsung attorney was examining Dennison, he used this phrase, crisis of design.
Well, we're having some connectivity issues there with Jeff, but hopefully we can get him back to delve a little bit more into the testimony on the case. I'm going to go ahead based on the icon of icons comment and make iconic our first MCLE passphrase for the show. So if you are looking for MCLE credit and you're in one of the jurisdictions where you need to demonstrate that you have watched the show, that's going to be the first passphrase for you to bear in mind. Evan, I know you've been out of town. This case has been unfolding. Do you have any thoughts on it?
Not substantively, really. I mean, you know, patent law is not what I do. And you know, I have an iPad, but I'm not a, you know, fanboy. What I see as interesting is some of the commentary about all of this that says that the courtroom appears to be kind of glum. You know, a lot of these cases have a different kind of, or, you know, a lot of the trial, the atmosphere in the courtroom has a different kind of feel than what this does. You know, there's a lot of frustration on the part of counsel. The executives of Apple and Samsung, you know, will not interact at all. Everybody's pretty angry at each other, which is weird, being that Samsung is one of Apple's biggest suppliers of parts. So they've got to figure out how to live somewhere. So there just seems to be a strange human element that's going on in this. Lots of frustration. You know, for example, John Quinn, you know, one of the lawyers for Samsung, got admonished by the judge today for making reference to a pretrial order on, you know, on issue. And so the judge didn't seem to believe that that was an unintentional slip, you know, because he said something in front of the presence, in the presence of the jury that he wasn't supposed to say. So just a lot of really a lot of negativity that's not characteristic of a lot of these complex trials. It sounds like it's a different environment than the Oracle versus Google courtroom, for example. So that's what's interesting as kind of an observation about it.
Yeah, there's a good op-ed over at Times site from Jared Newman, where he's sort of pondering what the overall purpose of the case has been. And he points out, actually, he's referencing yet someone else writing about this. Let me see if I can give credit where credit is due. The Loop's Jim Dalrymple, who's pointing out that it's really not about getting compensated for these products at issue in this suit. It's about drawing a line in the sand for things that are kind of come out in the future in 2013 and 2015 and beyond, and the fact that Apple is likely to go into the television arena where Samsung already is. That could be interesting. You know, Samsung's been doing TVs for some time. Maybe this could all be flipped on its head. But of course, if Apple does it, it's going to be significantly different than what people have done before. That's kind of its MO. Monica, have you been following the case, and do you have any thoughts?
I've been following it a little bit, again, like Evan, you know, not something, substantive, because patent is not really my area. Mm-hmm. But one thing that I do find that I have heard has come up is this, the term of the design patent. So you get a design patent for 14 years. And so what I understand is that Apple is saying, well, this Samsung phone looks very similar to our iPhone. And it's the iPhone, you know, if you break it down, I mean, are they getting a patent on a rectangle, a black rectangle? And should they get that kind of patent on a black rectangle? And should they get that patent for 14 years? Is that excessive? So I'm not sure what Evan or Jeff thinks about that, or yourself, Denise.
I mean, that seems to be one of the big issues, and it would be the voice that goes against the knee-jerk sensibilities that are expressed in Conan's piece, for example, making fun of us, like, oh my gosh, these things are so obvious. That really highlights what the challenge is for Samsung's defense in this, to say, you know, to get past all of this initial, you look at it. I mean, I'm holding up a phone here. You know, what is it? That was obviously an iPhone, right? So, you know, but to look at a more principled way that the patent laws and the design patent jurisprudence would require in all of this, in a way that's going to get past the prejudice, perhaps, that people would come in thinking that there really has been a copy here.
Yeah. I'm not a patent lawyer either, and that's why we like to get patent specialists on the show from time to time. But all of this discussion has made me wonder why we don't see, or maybe we actually do and just don't hear so much about, patent litigation more in the television arena. I mean, talk about the black rectangle problem. TVs pretty much, especially these days, are a black rectangle you hang on the wall, and they pretty much have the same functions, I guess, you know, when you get into the nitty-gritty of their menuing and stuff, but then whatever service you're retaining to bring broadcast to your TV generally takes over that role. Just seems to me like that area, if we're seeing it in the phone arena, why haven't we been seeing it with the classic black rectangle that hangs on the wall? I don't know the answer to that question. It just seems kind of bizarre to me. Jeff, you're back. Any thoughts before we move on?
Did y'all talk about the Samsung 132-page document when I was off?
No, we have not. We were waiting for you to jump back in and enlighten us.
What the interesting thing is, there's clearly, you know, anyone can look at the two designs and see that they're similar. So one of the questions is going to be, well, is this just because it's obvious anybody would do it this way? Or was there an intent to copy Apple? And of course, was Apple protecting something that's copyrightable in the first place? One of the things introduced into evidence this week was this 132-page document. You can see the whole thing on the All Things D website. And it's fascinating because it goes in incredible detail in everything about the iPhone that's even just a little bit different from the Samsung phone. And for virtually everyone, it has...
Well, Jeff is clearly the master of the cliffhanger for this show. I think he's gone again.
Yeah, this normally happens when we talk about network neutrality, so this is really odd.
Exactly. Are you there, Jeff? Are you there?
I hope I'm here. Who knows if
yes,
you can hear me or not.
Yes, you are. Okay, try and pick it up again.
The Samsung document, for every example where it shows a difference, their recommendation is, let's just go ahead and copy Apple. And so if I...
Alrighty then. We're going to endeavor to keep getting Jeff on in a more consistent way. But until we can do that, let us move on. Evan, you mentioned the Oracle versus Google case, which we talked about a lot on the show when it was a thing. It's not a thing anymore, although it is still pending in the trial court. And there was a pretty interesting order issued in that case. Not on any of the merits, the copyright and patent infringement claims asserted, but Judge Alsup in that case is concerned and wants the parties to disclose who they may have retained or paid, be they print or internet authors, journalists, commentators, or bloggers, who may have or already or may in the future publish comments on the issues concerning the case. The proceedings in this matter are almost over, the judge says, but they're not fully over, and the disclosure required by this order would be of use on appeal or on any remand to make clear whether any treatise, article, commentary, or analysis on the issues posed by this case are possibly influenced by financial relationships to the parties or counsel. So basically, Judge Alsup is putting himself in the same role as the FTC with bloggers last year, or maybe it was a couple of years ago now, about what you can and cannot write without disclosing it. Here, he actually wants the parties in the case to disclose if they have any journalistic shills out there, so that the, I guess, triers of fact in this case, not the jury here, but the judges involved on appeal and in the trial courts, will know if they're reading something that has been designed to persuade them. Evan, you remember a few shows back we talked about Google commissioning articles about their antitrust conundrums. Yep. From a group called the Amori Group, some very scholarly articles and some good thoughts on that, but they were commissioned by Google. So that's the kind of thing the court is looking to suss out here. You ever seen anything like this?
Well, I'm sure we could find something similar in other cases in the past. This mm-hmm. phenomenon appears to be only something that you would see in cases where, one, you have well-heeled litigants who have the means to pay content generators enough to be influential enough to get what their position is into places where it would be read by other commentators, and then that commentary could somehow get into a way of affecting the later proceedings on appeal. And then the other factor that would need to be present here is a situation, a case where the issues are so important and so, well, maybe it's still just a function of there being well-heeled parties. Maybe that's, mm-hmm. where the legal issues have the potential of being far-reaching, like we had in the Google versus Oracle case. It was a pretty significant legal question of whether or not the APIs are copyrightable, and if so, was there fair use? So, you know, there really is a lot of grist for the blogger, the blogging mill and the law review mill like this, arising from that type of situation. So I think, we should commend Judge Alsup for being proactive in this way, because given that set of circumstances, the important legal issues and the resources of the parties to affect public discourse about this in a certain way, that I think that he should be commended for ensuring that there is transparency here, so that the parties aren't getting something accomplished in a way that is extra judicial, in a very, very abstract way of affecting, the way that the appellate court would review its jurisprudence here. I think that's something that's good, and I'm glad that he issued that order. At least it was to both sides. It's not like he was trying to single one of the parties mm-hmm. out.
Yeah, so last week we saw Judge Koh upset over evidence that was excluded from trial but discussed with journalists and could possibly sway the jury if they had read any of that coverage. Now we see Judge Alsup attempting to, I think this is probably aimed more at the bench, letting them know, you know, if they're reading something that has been influenced financially in some way. Monica, is this something you've seen before?
No, and I've some of the commentary that I've read about this case also indicates that, you know, this is an unusual order. It's also unusual in that it's coming after the case has been decided, and it suggests that there's a possible appeal in the works. You know, one thing that it highlights is how connected, you know, the legal system is with public opinion and what is people saying in terms of in the press, and the press now includes blogs. And so, you know, that, you know, it highlights how sophisticated some of these litigation or litigants are around thinking about the trial process and the extent that they're willing to go to and will go to in order to make their case.
All right. Well, I think we've got Jeff back, audio only, which hopefully will help him. There we go. We've got a nice picture of him, too, which will help him be able to give us his final couple of notable things from the Apple versus Samsung trial this week. Jeff, you want to give it a try?
Sure. Although, to tell you the truth, those were the highlights. That, you know, the big 132-page Samsung document and the documents that John Quinn sort of opened the door to, in which, in fact, maybe I didn't say before, that document says that the difference between Samsung and Apple is truly that of heaven and hell. Again, you know, it's nothing but, you know, great sound bites for the Apple attorneys. So we'll see. You know, Samsung has been trying this case somewhat as if they are the underdog and they're being put upon. You know, just this morning I saw a report. You know, so many things have been happening to those poor Samsung attorneys. Just this morning, one of their attorneys apparently never even was a member of the bar. Of that court. She's a practicing California attorney, but just never was a member of the federal bar. And so they were getting in trouble about that. They have been getting in trouble left and right. Documents have been coming in. It's going to be interesting to see how much those sideshow matters affect the ultimate legal issue as to whether or not there was a copyright violation.
All right. Sorry, well, we appreciate that. IP. Go ahead.
No, I say copyright, of course. I mean the patent and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, we're glad we could get that in and close that thought. But right now I'm in the mood to take a trip to Scotland.
Section 230.
All right. And the reason we're going to Scotland is because a B&B there has a lovely name. Let me see if I can pull that up.
You're really going to try it?
No, I better not. Bile Nasil? I don't know. You can look at it in our show notes, which you can find at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/174. We have links to all the stories we've been discussing on the show. This one is from the Mail Online, and it's a small little B&B in Scotland. He says he's on the westernmost tip of Great Britain and is going after TripAdvisor, which they emphasize in this article over and over again, is a £2.3 billion company. So multiply that roughly by two for dollars if I've got my conversion rates accurate. And they are going after TripAdvisor about something that comes up over and over again. We talk about a lot on the show, the negative reviews on the site, which they say are adversely impacting their business. They're suing them in small claims court, which has a £3,000 limit of damages you can pursue. Looks like a very scenic place, but it's gotten some negative reviews about the food and the beds and the proprietor himself, Mr. Richard Gollan, who is the plaintiff in the suit. So this does come up over and over again, and mostly, you know, the result is if these this is kind of the crux of it. Review sites want to be able to share negative opinions about the institutions that are covered. They want transparency to be there. They want free speech on behalf of their users. So they mostly say, you know, hey, we didn't author this, and if there's something wrong with it, you need to go after the individual. But I'm wondering, Evan, if you think that, you know, in a case like this, it might be difficult to do in a small claims kind of environment. There is an opportunity to get into the methodology used by the site to ensure that the reviews that they're getting and publishing are legitimate and are not, you know, some kind of guerrilla tactic to damage a business's reputation.
Yeah. I mean, what we have here is a factual pattern that we've seen play out many, many times, both just reading about cases like this, and I've had all kinds of clients, prospective clients, come to me who are being the subject of rough treatment online and have represented, you know, people in the position of the intermediary, like what TripAdvisor is here, who are having these user-generated content sites, and they worry about the risk of liability for what their users post on this. So there are a number of questions that we would need to examine, a number of pretty simple questions that we would need to examine to really get to the heart of this situation with this small claims lawsuit over in Scotland. And the first one would be, I would want to ask somebody who knows about, you know, the law that applies in Scotland, whether there is some kind of analogous version of a law that looks like what Section 230 does here in the United States. Section 230, of course, being that provision in the Communications Decency Act, which says that the provider of a website can't be treated as, you know, can't be held liable in tort for most of the things that its users post on the site, which if that were the law in Scotland that applies here, then TripAdvisor, unless it's shown that it was the publisher of this information, and it's going to say that its users were, unless it can show that TripAdvisor was the publisher, then TripAdvisor would enjoy a form of immunity. It sounds like TripAdvisor is also arguing here, or, you know, I'm not going to say also, because I don't think they're making that argument of immunity yet. They're just saying, hey, we're a U.S. company. We're not subject to the jurisdiction of the courts over there in Scotland. But who knows what could really happen? Crazy things happen in small claims court, and given the fact that Monica is with us here, we may have opportunity to talk about that a bit. Who knows what the small claims court judge over there in Scotland may find when it comes to all this. But there's no doubt that this is a really widespread and perennial problem for small business owners. And I can imagine it's particularly bad for proprietors of bed and breakfasts and small inns, because the clientele who visits those kinds of places are so picky and so, you know, detail oriented. I can imagine that would just be such a stressful vocation to have, making people happy, you know, charging them a bunch of money to come and stay in your country inn and making their experience perfect. That would be a tough job to be in. But that's a separate issue, of course.
Yes, and possibly a sweeping generalization, but we'll just let that go. Monica, I think you sent this story our way. What do you think about all this?
You know, Evan highlighted some of the issues that, you know, with these particular types of cases, and he's absolutely right. This is coming up a lot. A point that I think might be interesting to people is that in Canada, we don't actually have a 230. And from what I understand in the UK, they also don't have a Section 230. So we don't have the intermediaries don't have that protection that the intermediaries have in the US. So it makes it for really difficult to be one of these sites in Canada, because you are open to these types of claims where somebody's, you know, comes for a TripAdvisor or comes after like another type of review site and says, well, you are defaming me online. And that's the type of argument they make, is that this is online defamation. And the other challenges is that many times these reviewers they come on, they make the posting, but they don't want to actually be involved in the dispute. So I kind of see these review sites as being a playground or an area where the disputes are playing out. So instead of going to small claims court or, you know, going to the person and saying, you know, I didn't like your service, and having that kind of dispute. They're going online and they're vetting, or they're, you know, praising people online. And what you see, I think, on the review sites is you see people who are really, really satisfied, or you see reviews that are people who are really, really dissatisfied. And in this particular case, you know, if you look at some of the comments in this particular article, and I have it right in front of me. So some of the comments is, you know, the first one is, most of this B&B's comments are very positive. So why is this winger complaining about a couple of less than perfect ones? So so in this particular case, he actually has quite most of his reviews. If you look at it online, I think he has about 52 reviews. I think about 30 plus of them are positive, and he's got some that are negative. What I understand is that actually people do like to see the negative reviews. So if you had a company that had only positive reviews, you know, people are going to look at that kind of skeptically. But sometimes, you know, it's like a brand new world with small businesses. They're trying to understand, what do these reviews mean? They do know that it has an impact on their businesses. You know, it's still, you know, kind of working its way through the system, I think.
Yes, he's sort of Streisand affecting himself by bringing the lawsuit and bringing attention to the negative reviews. Jeff, I feel you. You know, I've been there where I've had to drop off the show and come back, and they cut my video, and then we're audio only. But hopefully we've got you, and you're still with us.
Hopefully, we'll see.
Yes. I'm curious as to, I'm thinking that in one of these cases, this may not be the case, but I'm thinking that despite Section 230, someone is going to demand, some judge is going to demand that one of these sites, whether it's Yelp or TripAdvisor or just one of the very well-known review sites, justify its methodology for making sure that someone is not subject to some kind of targeted campaign that has nothing to do with giving a legitimate review of the site or the doctor or whoever it may be. What do you think about that?
Right. You know, on the one hand, you have sites like YouTube where, I mean, the last thing that anyone wants to ever do is read comments on a YouTube video because they're horrible. But then sites like TripAdvisor and Yelp, in many ways, the value of the site is the reviews. And so I can definitely see an argument that they ought to be more responsible for them. But the flip side, and where I ultimately come out, and I hope that the UK and Canadian courts come out too, is that, you know, I think it's more important to be open and just let all the opinions come out, and let the let people decide that if there's 100 good reviews and 2 bad ones because somebody had bad spaghetti on a Thursday night, that doesn't mean that the restaurant's horrible and no one else should go there. And so, you know, I hope that cases like this do not succeed, because I would rather be in a world where everyone can have their viewpoint out there, and we all know that there's going to be some people you disagree with, and you just have to be the conscious consumer to filter out something that, you know, you decide probably is not going to be relevant to you, but I'd rather have it there in the first place so you could make that decision.
All right. Well, we're going to have, we've talked a lot about Professor Eric Goldman on the show today. He's going to be one of our guests next week. So I don't know how we would ever have a show without discussing Section 230 with him. So I'm sure we'll get back into this again when we pick this up next week. But this has been an interesting little sojourn to Scotland. And now we're going to move on over to New York and hang out a bit with Mike Tyson. And we'll make Mike Tyson our second MCLE passphrase for the show. What's going on with Mike is he's doing a show. He's a Broadway guy now. And apparently, the New York police had picked up a tweet from someone that was making some sort of a threat or a plan of an attack on the theater where that show is going on. And they went to Twitter. Now, here I'm procedurally unclear on exactly what's gone forth. And if anyone knows the details, either in chat or on the show here, do let me know. But what the CNN piece that I'm checking out here says is that the police asked Twitter, requested from Twitter, the personal information of the person believed to have made this threat or plan. Now, I don't know if that ask consisted of a phone call or a subpoena. And I think that that might very well make a difference. But however the request was made, it was not complied with. Twitter did not turn over the information. I'm thinking that, you know, it's going to take either a subpoena or a court order to get that kind of information. In the wake of what happened in Colorado and Wisconsin recently, obviously you feel for the police wanting to nip this kind of thing in the bud. But, you know, you contrast that against the two people from Britain who we talked about on the show some time ago who were flying over here, and one of them tweeted that they wanted to destroy America, and they were then detained by security in Los Angeles and generally had their lives made miserable, and I believe were shipped back to the UK without having any sort of opportunity to enjoy their trip. So, you've got a whole spectrum in between there, and Twitter's kind of caught in the middle. Obviously, they want to protect law enforcement and innocent bystanders on the one hand, and yet they owe responsibilities to their users and their personal information on the other. So it's a real tough spot. Evan, what do you think about this?
I think this issue was probably resolved as early as 1789 when they passed the Fourth Amendment. You know, Yeah, we've got to be cognizant of what happened in Aurora, Colorado, and at the Sikh temple outside of Milwaukee. And we've got to be perhaps more vigilant and more sensitive at some times, given the recent context, than others. But at the same time, the mechanism for ensuring an individual's security in their effects, persons, papers, whatever it is that the Fourth Amendment says, you know, which has been translated as a right of privacy in this kind of context, is the mechanism for that, at least in the United States, has been to you go to a judge and you get a warrant. And if the judge, who in an ideal world is supposed to be objective and look at what the factual situation is, will give a thumbs up or a thumbs down as to whether or not the interest at stake in finding out something about this person is substantial enough to override whatever kind of privacy right he or she may have. So what I don't know what's actually going on in the situation. I'm more unclear than what you are, Denise, about what's actually going on procedurally and all this stuff. What I really hope did not happen is that law enforcement did just, you know, send a fax or something like that asking Twitter, because
knowing then, law enforcement, it would be a fax.
Yeah. And so, you know, that's obviously doesn't comport with these principles that have been around since well before 1789. So if there was a guy really putting out a tweet that a credible person would conclude therefrom that he was going to go do something harmful to Mike Tyson at a theater in New York, and, you know, there'd be some collateral damages there to the people watching the show, then by God, get a warrant, get, you know, whatever it is, go to Twitter. Twitter will comply with it. They're not going to be arbitrary about this. Twitter wants to comply with the law. The complaints they've made in the past are, you know, much more in gray areas. I have no reason to doubt that Twitter wouldn't respond to something that was clearly based on probable cause and done, you know, the correct way.
Right.
Especially Monica, for Twitter.
Go ahead, Jeff.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, Twitter, is there a platform that is more public by nature than Twitter? I mean, I know you can have direct messages, but everything about Twitter is being public. And I don't think that anybody would have a reasonable expectation of privacy that they can shout something to the world by putting it in a tweet and then not have someone, you know, come back and try to find out who they are. So, you know, I don't have much sympathy for that side of that argument, for a service like Twitter, at least.
Yeah, and I mean, I do the facts to Twitter. I fully hope that Twitter would look askance at and say, you know, as Evan suggested, you've got to give us more than this if you want us to help out here. What do you think, Monica?
So just a follow up with the story. Supposedly there was a court order after. Mm-hmm. So the government officials asked for the account information. Twitter denied. Mm-hmm. Then they went to the court, they got a court order, and now Twitter has provided the account information to the police. But what's interesting is Twitter has a Twitter transparency report, and according to the Twitter Transparency Report, there has been 679 information requests from the government in the first half of 2012. Mm-hmm. And Twitter has provided some or all of the information for 75% of those requests. Now, it's unclear to me whether or not those requests are in the form of a court order or if they're these faxes that we were alluding to before. But if they were faxes, then the question is why, you know, would they release information in one context and not in this context where there's, you know, we're right after the math of Aurora and the, you know, shooting in at the Sikh temple as well. So,
yep. Well, I'm just glad that we've had the opportunity once again to talk about Mike Tyson on the show. I think this is our second go round with the champ there. We
Denise, could he be a guest on an upcoming episode? I'd like to hear Mike Tyson on the law.
I would love to. You know, he's got a couple of things where he's been very topical for us. This and his tattoo, which when used in the Hangover movies, or when he appeared in the Hangover movies, occasioned litigation and saber rattling. So you gotta love Mike Tyson. All right. So we have alluded to the fact that Monica runs this great site called My Legal Briefcase, which helps make small claims processes more accessible. Monica, before we're going to make that our resource of the week, and I'm going to let you tell people about it. But before you do, can you give us some context about sort of the judicial system? You're in Canada, we're in the United States. Things are fairly similar across our borders. What occasioned you to start this site, and why do you think there's a need for this kind of enhanced access to the general public to the court system?
Well, Denise, let me go back a little bit and talk a little bit about my background. So I actually started in the tech industry. I used to be a computer engineer and designing computer chips and stuff. And I'm a graduate from Stanford. I have a master's in electrical engineering from Stanford University. And then I made the transition into law. And one of the things that I noticed when I started practicing was there was two things. One was this stark contrast between, you know, my experience as a computer engineer where the emphasis was around efficiency, productivity, process. And we were constantly thinking about that. And when I started practicing in law, it just seemed to be like the ante in terms of efficiency or thinking about that. And the second was, you know, it just really struck me how I could even afford my own services. So I was looking at what I was billing, what, you know, the firm was billing me out at. And I thought, you know, that's really is not a sustainable in terms of being affordable, accessible to people. This, you know, coupled with the fact that what we were seeing and what we see in the US and Canada is a growing number of people who are going to court by themselves. And I see that as a direct, directly occurring from the fact that, you know, legal services are expensive, especially for claims that are under $25,000. So there's two trends that I was seeing in the courts. One was that the small claims court, a lot of jurisdictions were increasing the amount that you could sue for. So, for example, in California, they increased the small claims limit from, I think it was 8,000 before January 2012, and now it's been increased to $10,000. And the same trend in Ontario, we have, you can sue up to $25,000 in the small claims court. So it's no longer small. And what happens though is people go to the small claims court and they feel like, you know, they could do it themselves, and that's what they're told. You can go to court and you can represent yourself, but it's still a legal process, and people are still struggling to figure out what the rules are. And so what I developed was a software to assist people in kind of creating the documents or the forms that they would need to submit to the small claims court, as well as a workflow. So it's like, you know, first you send a demand letter, and then after you send a demand letter, then you would send a statement of claim or a plaintiff's claim, depending on where which state you're in. And then you might have to serve the defendant. In some states, you know, the courts will do the service, but it depends which state you're in. So it's a workflow. So it's not just about the documents, but it's also about what are your steps that you take. And so that's how I got started with the My Legal Briefcase.
That's great. I think, you know, I think it's great. I think a lot of lawyers look at this and go, well, even though small claims is supposed to be for unrepresented litigants, we saw in our story about the B&B owner that that person had retained counsel. A lot of people do when they go to small claims court, but it should be a more streamlined process, I think. We talked on Twit 345 with Matt Spaccarelli. He's the guy who sued AT&T in small claims court over their kind of bait and switch with the unlimited iPhone data plans. You remember those, Jeff?
Yeah.
So he actually, because he sued them in small claims court and you know, I think got their attention, or they at least had to show up, managed to get a, not a large settlement, but a settlement out of them, and at least bring some publicity to the issue. And,
I was
going to
say, the significant thing there was not just that he was using small claims court, but that he had the AP or whoever was doing the story. So he had, you know, a worldwide audience plus small claims court, which is probably not what the typical small claims court litigant gets. So that was very helpful for him.
And when you couple up, you know, a situation like that where there are a bunch of consumers who might feel similarly to Matt, that they'd like to have some recourse from a big company like AT&T, and a streamlined tool like My Legal Briefcase, that could start to be a significant thorn in AT&T's side. Monica, do you think that your tool and others like, what is it called, LegalZoom, there's a Rocket something, I don't know. I don't know them all, but certainly there are quite a few places where people can go and get their legal documents and, you know, come very close to not practicing law, but helping people navigate the court system without the aid of lawyers. Do you think we're all just becoming irrelevant and the joys of technology are going to make this all a lot easier for people?
No, I don't think that's going to happen. But what I do think is happening is you have the internet has changed how people are looking for information. And this is what I see. People go onto Google, like they have a problem. They go onto Google and they type in their problem into Google. And that could be, you know, I'm sick and I've got a headache and a runny nose. And what does that mean? Or, you know, and they call it the WebMD effect, but in legal, you're seeing the same thing. So people are going onto Google, they're searching for some information. They want some guideline of how to proceed before they go and they engage with a lawyer. So I personally don't think that, you know, lawyers are going to be obsoleted by technology. But what I do think is going to happen is some of the lower end where, you know, people are trying to figure out what do they do, and coming to the lawyer with some kind of ideas about what they need versus, you know, just coming to a lawyer without having a prior understanding of their issues. So I think that's what's going to happen in the short term. And the other trend I see is a lot of people are connecting with lawyers online. So, you know, even LegalZoom and even the other website that you're referring to, the Rocket Lawyer, they are, you know, one of the main things they do is connect people with lawyers. So you can come on there. You could, you know, maybe you start by filling out a document. Eventually, though, people do want some kind of assistance with their issue. And it just helps them in terms of managing their costs. So I think what we're going to see is more and more people kind of, and lawyers being more flexible in terms of how, what their role is going to be in a particular process, be it litigation or creating a will or doing an incorporation.
Yeah. I think that's a good way of looking at it. Evan, do you ever get clients who second guess you and say, well, have you considered collateral estoppel or some other theory?
They're always bringing up the rule in Shelley's case and its perpetuities for some reason. I don't know what that's all about. So,
yeah.
No, but I mean, you know, I definitely see the impact, the effect of well-educated clients. And I think that's a great thing because the more information is there, the more likely is that good decisions can be made, because bad decisions are usually made due to some form of ignorance, you know, and some not knowing all the facts, not knowing all the consequences of a particular course of action. So, I mean, going to the question of whether or not technology will make lawyers obsolete, I mean, I would say we should never underestimate the potential for technology to affect our lives. And so I would only be willing to talk about whether lawyers will be replaced by machines up to the point of the singularity. But after that, who knows what kind of things will be able to happen, you know, as far as the provision of services that are based on analysis and information and all of the things that lawyers do. It really is a knowledge management kind of field. But in like Monica's talking about, in the short term, there's certainly no doubt that new information tools have the ability to greatly affect the way that people interact with lawyers, the way that people find lawyers in the first place, and perhaps most interestingly for the practicing attorney is the ways that lawyers will actually do their business. It's so fascinating to see the way that semantic technologies are affecting things like electronic discovery and document review, and the potential is there to really affect the way semantic search, for example, could help in legal research, you know, finding concepts that are analogous that would never show up in the traditional way of legal research. So, what Monica is doing is just a great way that's operating at that layer to the way that technology can really provide information to people to help them make good decisions and be able to have a greater access to the system. And that's a very visible and positive development in the way technology affects our culture.
All right, so My Legal Briefcase is our resource of the week, and our tip of the week comes to us from Vincent Brown on Google+. Thank you, Vincent. It's a kind of a niche tip. You have to have both an iPad with one of the new magnetic covers that came out with the iPad 2 and an iMac to make this work. But and it's a problem that a lot of people are concerned about. The article that we have comes from vintuitive.com and sort of casts it as, the John Dvorak problem, that maybe you're a little bit too paranoid and too worried about what your camera might be doing, but your camera might be doing things that you don't like, and some people just put duct tape over it. Personally, for me, I have to always, you know, keep my camera on, make sure I'm looking at it when we're doing the show, because I tend to, you know, wander off into space, look at my notes. But so this is not so much a tip for me, but for those of you out there who are more concerned with making sure that your camera's not doing funny things when you don't want to, what you can do is there are actually magnets built into your iMac that will attach to that iPad cover case. So if you want to just flip the cover over the camera, it will adhere to your iMac and you can drape it over the back. He recommends that you then fold it up in the back so it's not interfering with the computer's ventilation system. But it makes an awfully nice little camera cover, and you don't have to be putting tape, or as I do in if you were sitting here looking at my computer, sticky note right by the camera that has a big smiley face on it so that I remember to look up there. I suppose I could just move my sticky note over when we're done with the show, but I hardly ever do that. All right, so that's our tip, and this has been our show. We really appreciate you joining us here on August 10th. The long, hot summer in the United States drones on, but we're going to be here for you every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific, 1800 UTC, if you want to watch the show with us live while we record. If you're not one of our live viewers or listeners, you can find us on iTunes and, of course, at our website at twit.tv/twill, on YouTube, on Roku, wherever you like to get your podcast-oriented content. We're going to be there for you. We also have a wiki with our show notes, all our MCLE information. I've been alluding to that in the show. There's a nice rundown there prepared by our wonderful intern, Franklin Graves, this summer. all the information you'll need to be able to apply for MCLE credit in your jurisdiction as we move on and try and get ourselves accredited to make that even easier for you. And I think that's just about all I need to say, except that we'd love to hear from you between the shows. My email is denise@twit.tv. Evan is evan@twit.tv. If you're shy about email or want to interact with us more in public, we've got a Facebook page and a Google Plus page where we do much of the same thing. We love to hear from you. We love your ideas for the show, for tips, for resources, for stories we should be following, covering. And on that Facebook and Google Plus page throughout the week, I'll let you know who our upcoming guests are going to be and what we plan to talk about. Evan, any final thoughts as we close out the show here?
No, other than to just encourage people again to follow Sarcastic Rover for updates of what's going on, for what's really not going on with Curiosity in the Gale Crater on Mars. Good stuff. Funny stuff. Very timely.
Yes. I forget who it was that tweeted that Curiosity had an accident and had run over a cat. But I don't think that was Sarcastic Rover. I think that was someone with a much more groaner sense of humor. Sarcastic Rover's pretty much dead on.
Yes.
Evan, it's great to have you back. Glad I'm sure you're not glad to no longer be sojourning around tropical climes, but we're glad you've returned.
It's part of it. It's part of it. It's just one of those occupational hazards, you know, coming back to work. So there you go. But
exactly.
I've enjoyed our conversation. It's been great. Monica, Jeff, great to talk with you. And, you know, always fun. Always a blast. Yeah.
It is. And of course, folks, you can find Evan over there at internetcases.com, and he's Internet Cases on Twitter. Monica Goyle, it's been great meeting you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yep. Thanks for having me. It was fun.
It was fun. Of course, we've told people to go check out My Legal Briefcase. Monica's also on Twitter and Google Plus, so you can find her there. And good luck up there in Toronto.
Thank you.
Jeff, great to have you back.
Thank you, Denise. It was great to be back, notwithstanding the video problems. Twill is such a great show. It's always fun to listen and to be a part of it.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure. It must be fun to be covering all things iPhone these days.
I tell you, it gets more exciting every day, and we're all looking forward to perhaps next month when we'll see a brand new iPhone, maybe a miniature iPad, who knows what else.
I know. I'm looking forward to it. I managed to take my iPhone underwater with me on vacation in similar tropical climes in a life-proof case. And it did not, those cases work well, but I think I just punished mine beyond the limits of what they're supposed to do. So when I got back, the iPhone was actually surprisingly functional, but I had to take it in and you know, swap it out for the replacement model. But I did not upgrade because I'm waiting. You need to tell me when that 5 is going to appear on the scene, because goodness, Siri and I need to get acquainted, I think.
Yes. Good talking to you, Denise and Evan, and nice to meet you, Monica.
You too. You can find Jeff over at iphonejd.com, and he's Jeff Richardson on Twitter. And with that, we hope you have a lovely weekend and the rest of your day, and we will see you next time on This Week in Law. Take care.